So there's this wonderful quote from Sir John Templeton. He says, "Bull markets are born on pessimism, they grow on skepticism, they mature on optimism, and they die on euphoria." And that's what sentiment and really psychology is all about. Markets are all about psychology fundamentally, but the stories and narratives we tell ourselves and each other, including how we assign value, and value is subjective. So the best time to buy crypto was immediately after Genesis failed, after they blocked their accounts. The outlook was bleak. That's pessimism. And you can see in the discount to NAV and the ETH and GBTC between 30-50%. You could see it.
You're listening to Because of Bitcoin, a podcast that shares the personal stories of how Bitcoin is having a real impact in people's lives, including mine. I'm your host, Mauricio Di Bartolomeo, the co-founder and CSO of Ledit. And without further ado, let's get started with today's story. One of the biggest challenges of living in a fiat system is that it forces all of us to have two jobs. Your first job is the one you need to generate income to pay for your day-to-day living expenses and to generate savings that you can use in a rainy day or when you want to retire. The second job is that we're also forced to become investors. And this is because we've learned through fire that keeping your savings in fiat or dollars and earning 0% at a bank doesn't cut it when inflation is eating away at our savings at around 10% each year. What many people miss is that it's the second job, investing your hard-earned money, the one that can materially change your stars. The reason for this is that investing compounds, and investments can grow passively. As an example, most people have made their fortunes not because of their paychecks, but because the value of their principal residence or the commercial building they bought a long time ago to do their business appreciated materially. Most of us don't have time to efficiently do the two jobs. And while you cannot outsource your day-to-day job to someone else, you can find investment advisors and professionals that can help you manage those investments. These are people who spend their entire lives looking at the markets, understanding how they are interconnected, and using that to find opportunities. One of the smartest minds in this space is Ram Ahluwalia. I've been following Ram for several years now, and I had the pleasure of sitting down with him to discuss the world of investment management and digital assets. I hope you enjoyed our conversation as much as I did. Ram, how are you, man?
I'm doing well, Mauricio. How are you?
I'm doing very, very well. I've been really looking forward to this chat because you had some great questions in the pod we did with Alex and Noel recently in the Bits and Bits podcast. And just from your questions, I knew you understood our business particularly well. I was doing some research here and I was going deeper into your professional background, and it became very clear why you get this stuff so well. But we'll get into that.
I enjoyed the chat very much. I wanted to kind of high-five you through the screen. I'm looking at things from a principal's perspective, and you bring that to the table, but also like a lived real experience perspective. And it's great because you get to validate a hypothesis, like, oh, this is what's going on. You're like, oh, I see, man, that's me. I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool.
That's awesome, man. And you don't just cover digital assets. I really enjoy your views on the broader markets in general, equities, etc. And I'm hoping to draw a bunch of insights from you throughout this conversation. The way I typically like to start the show is to get behind the scenes of the professional that we all know today. And the way I typically open the show is asking you what it was like growing up in your household, and was money or finance a big topic at the dinner table or lunch table?
Really interesting question. So look, I'm the son of an immigrant. My father immigrated from India. He did his residency in Detroit in the late 70s. It wasn't a nice town back then. My dad used to go to work with a $20 bill in his wallet, just in case he got mugged. He would just hand them the $20 bill. So then we moved to upstate New York. He wanted to be closer to his family, a better area, small town, 2,000 people or so. And those experiences, I think, were formative in the sense that I was always on the outside looking in. And you know, my investment philosophy is non-consensus. And it's learning how the jungle works, what the rules of the road are. And those were impressions I had growing up. I never really felt like I was in the club, so to speak. I was always non-consensus. Even at Columbia, where I went to undergrad, I studied philosophy and economics. I was always on the more classical liberal, what modern people would say libertarian, side of things. And I was always into the classic philosophers and Immanuel Kant and championing the Renaissance as peaks of human achievement. And that's really not popular these days.
It's really interesting, your dad's $20 bill, because growing up in Venezuela, my dad made me carry 100 bolivares always in my wallet. It was in case I got robbed, because the danger of somebody going through the trouble of robbing you and then getting no bounty would oftentimes increase the risk of them hurting you. And so it's funny to hear someone else get to that insurance policy through just trial and error. And it's sad, but it's true.
Something else I read growing up was Gary Becker. He used to have a column on the last page of Business Week, which is a magazine that, I don't know, doesn't really circulate so much anymore. But I had a chance to meet him. He's a Nobel laureate. He was at the University of Chicago. He was also a friend of Milton Friedman. And so he pioneered the field of human behavior and economics, like studying how incentives shape human behavior. He would study like divorce rates as they relate to state policies and costs of divorce, for example. He'd say, well, if you have low entry and exit costs, and they happen more often, and if you have high entry and exit costs, they happen less. Now, this guy kind of knows something here. Come on, to learn from that. Like, why is popcorn expensive at a movie theater when it's cheap to make, and explaining the monopoly dynamics, or why does the mafia exist? Why do you have governance structures in extra legal activity? You have two people that want to have a voluntary consenting transaction the government denies. Usually there's some other entity, in this case the mob, that steps in to provide those services. Think about like markets, same thing. You have certain segments of investors that have certain behaviors and respond to certain incentives. So those are things that influence me.
That's brilliant. My other question was, I saw you do have a Bachelor of Economics and Philosophy from Columbia University, which is a great alma mater, by the way. But I got the sense that what you do today, and when I see this original bachelor degree, were you already interested in finances when you decided for that degree, or does that come later?
Yes and no. Look, in high school, I was always building businesses, building websites. My freshman year in college, I was the only one with a Visa MasterCard terminal in my dorm room. I was building websites and swapping payments. It was kind of funny. I had a Visa logo on my door. And so I had some basic sense of the payment system just through that experience and how interchange worked. I always loved building businesses, but my initial passion was always physics, actually. So I actually applied to Columbia as a physics major. I was studying math. It goes hand in hand with philosophy and even religion, too. Like, why are we here? What's the meaning of life? What is there really? You know, I realized that after my freshman year that when I looked around the room, it was me and like eight guys, all of whom I think had Asperger's syndrome that were certainly smarter than me. And I said, you know, if I go down this path, I'm going to be working at Fermilab 2 miles underground. And that's probably not the best lifestyle. So I had a crush on a girl, my friend, in economics. I said, what class do you take? She said, economics. I said, oh, okay. Let's take some economics classes. Then I fell in love with economics, forgot about the girls. I fell in love with Milton Friedman, Gary Becker, and Friedman Hayek, Road to Serfdom, which are books you read in the core curriculum at Columbia, by the way. You read Road to Serfdom as it's required. So my passion has changed, right? And you think about what rule of law is, what's the right way to govern, what's the right way to organize society.
That's fascinating, man. So many threads to pull, but I want to keep the progression because I want to get into the current events and your views on the market. From university, you started as a national defense analyst. I wish I had another hour on this pod to talk to you about that. Then you worked at one of the biggest banks in the world, Bank of America. Then you started your own business, sold it to another bank. And then you led digital assets at that bank. Then you went on to your second venture, which is where you are today. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah. When I graduated in 2001, in the middle of a recession, I had an offer that was deferred. So they said, Ron, we'll hire in a year, go do something. So I said, let me apply for an opportunity at the Cato Institute, which was a libertarian public policy think tank. It's where I actually had a chance to shake the hands of Milton and Rose Friedman, his wife, and me, Gary Becker. By the way, I was like a 20-year-old kid. Yeah, I was being paid a minimum wage. I was doing analytical work for national defense policy people, but I wasn't a hardcore analyst, to be clear, right? I was helping write op-eds, which actually I've done now. In the room with the other interns, the value is having these incredibly engaging intellectual debate with one another around things like what's the role of government and what are the right kind of policies. That was a wonderful, it was great. I probably get paid the least I ever did, but in another sense, it was the most rewarding and enriching experience ever had. So then I learned to manage a consulting, a lot of data analytics, worked with a lot of banks as customers. That's also been a common theme in my career too. I was at Merrill and we bought a bank there called First Republic. And then in 2008, we sold First Republic because Merrill Lynch needed capital and liquidity. Capital and liquidity is a key theme in how I feel about the world and the banking system. I realized that there are a lot of dislocations in the bond market. These securitizations have lost a lot of value. S&G made this value in buying them. I didn't really know much about how that worked, but I knew how loans worked, not securitizations. So I had a small asset manager. We're buying these assets. It turned out that they were worth a lot more than the banks were selling them for. The banks were selling them 5 cents on the dollar. It turns out securitization worked, actually. These bonds are actually worth like 50, 80, 85 cents on the dollar. So you remember the movie The Big Short? The big irony is that more money was made on the big long than the big short, right? So I was part of the big long. So we were buying what are called non-agency residential mortgage-backed securities, all the things that blew up the financial system. But the securitization machine actually worked in part because house prices went up also. That worked the underlying collateral backing the bonds.
Right.
So I learned about distress investing. I learned about securitization. We were using analysts to figure out the price of these bonds. I started doing my first angel investing and venture investing too. So I learned about that. You know, one of the companies went public called Lending Club. So I learned about the IPO process. I also learned about all the hot air and venture capital too at the same time. Oh, this is all storytelling. Oh, it's like you're mostly lucky most of the time. Like, okay, I get it now. I remember after Lending Club went public, how do we hedge the hell out of this thing? How do I get this shit off my balance sheet? Assess the chem. So I learned about, you know, how that game works. The broader story here, just I was having experience in building different asset classes with a background in data analytics and the financial system with banking, right? Then I built a company called PureIQ. Our clients were credit hedge funds, were providing data analytics, helped banks and hedge funds buy loans from Lending Club and all these other players in the SoFi's of the world. I sold that to Cross River Bank a few years ago. It's A16Z Ribbit-backed bank here in New Jersey. Built the crypto business while I was there. I love building. And so I said, let's go build a crypto business. So we power Coinbase. If you go to Coinbase and you have an ACH or wire transaction to deposit funds for a fiat ramp, that's powered by Cross River. So you'll see that there. So I'm building Limited Wealth. We're an SEC registered investment advisor or venture backed. And we want to disrupt the old guard of TREF. I want to disrupt Merrill Lynch, JP Morgan, Goldman. Do it the right way. Do wealth management the right way. Modern, digitally native. Think about digital assets. Think about alternative assets. Use analytics and link that with trust and tax as well, and tax mitigation. So that's what we're doing. It's the kind of place where I'd want to put my money, which is what I do.
It's fascinating how many times the entrepreneurial story becomes, I had a problem, no one was doing it the way I wanted it, I went and did it, and now other people like what I did. It's a story as old as time. And in many ways, it's very similar to Ledin. We were mining, nobody gave us a loan. The guys that did, we thought were lunatics. They were adding tokens to their stuff and supporting all sorts of assets. And we're like, no, I want to put my money there. And so we built something that we would want to put our money in, and then they ballooned into what you see today. So brilliant story, and reinforces this idea that when you're solving your own problem, you're most likely solving someone else's. At what point in this whole journey does Bitcoin come into the radar? When did you find Bitcoin?
So November of 2013, I was approached by a VC from Conversion Capital. His name is Christian Lawless. And he said, Ram, what's your view on this exchange called LedgerX? It wasn't called LedgerX back then, but you know, it's a derivatives exchange. And so I know that was a time when I first encountered Bitcoin or had awareness of it, because I had this email there. Because I was wondering myself, like, when did I come across Bitcoin? So I sent them an email, and the conclusion was, don't invest in this thing. But the first sentence is, Bitcoin is super cool, which is one of those incredibly naive statements in a certain respect. Like, the funny thing is, Christian and I were trying to figure out, should we invest in the derivatives exchange? When the real thing was just, oh, it's Bitcoin. Yeah, it's like, do you want to invest in the derivative of Bitcoin, or is Bitcoin itself? And I met David Namdar during that experience as well, Peter, and he was that guy. So I didn't get much exposure, to be quite candid, though. You know, I think I got my first Bitcoin. It was literally on Wall Street, actually, which I lived at. I lived on 45 Wall Street, but it was early days. Unfortunately, I didn't get much exposure, but intellectually, I was fascinated immediately.
Well, I first found you when you started writing incredible content, by the way, around the Genesis bankruptcy. This was back in late 2022, and I'm in the space. When somebody that I haven't come across before writes about something and your views aligned with my views and your insights were very aligned with the way I was thinking about it, I instantly knew I had to continue following you. And you wrote about this from a lens that only people involved in the process would have. You went through extreme depths to understand what was happening, what were the incentives on the other side of the negotiation. So I guess the question I had was, were you just an astute observer? Or how did you become aware? And were you or your clients or friends involved? What piqued your interest?
I've never had a commercial relationship with the DCG, Genesis, or Gemini. I tried to have a relationship with Gemini. They couldn't get me through KYC. Larry, you've heard of our story. So I had some experiences out of the financial crisis of 2008, which was all about bank failures. And one of the weak points of banks is this thing called fractional reserve banking or rehypothecation. It works until it doesn't work. You need a lender of last resort. You need liquidity to make it work. The Federal Reserve provides that. And what I saw in Genesis, I said, this is the next AIG, because they were a non-bank acting as a bank. They took in customer deposits. They turned around, they lent them out, but they didn't have a lender of last resort. And they were making term loans. They had an asset liability mismatch. Those were some of the key lessons, among others, from the financial crisis. Again, I was at Merrill, the center of the storm, in 2008. So when you have those experiences, how you look at the world changes fundamentally. It's like, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. You're not going to get rug pulled that way again.
Right.
So you really understand what happened. And when I looked at Genesis, DCG, and others too, like BlockFi, I was critical about BlockFi and Celsius. I think I was in the last panel with Alex Mashinsky, and I was calling him out, and people didn't give me the time of day. He was like, oh, Alex, can I get your autograph after this? That was the vibe of it. You had to be careful what you're saying in public, because you can get accused of defamation, of course.
Yeah.
I knew the shit coming out of his mouth didn't make any sense, but it's hard for the public to understand that. It's like, oh, we approved a reserve. Where and who? What third-party audit and what custodian? No, none of that exists, right? So anyway, those things, as you can see, just kind of bother me and irritate me. And I'd been rug-pulled myself in the past. You know, I had an MF Global account, and the counsels we said rated and domicile, and they weren't. And they lied and misrepresented. So I lived those extremes. Like, I see this thing coming. You know, when Michael Moritz, CEO of Genesis, said on Twitter, I think in June of 22, he said, we have fully shed the risk from 3AC. At that point, I knew something was terribly wrong, because there's only a finite number of ways you can shed your risk. You can sell the asset, but that means you recognize a loss on your P&L, and someone's got to buy that off of you. You sell, you're just crystallizing a loss.
Yep.
Or you buy CDS, but who's going to write you the CDS?
No one does that.
So I said, this doesn't make any sense, what he said. I asked him in that thread, in the name of good faith, I said, hey, Michael, how did you do that? Here are your options. Which one was it? It was purely from a point of view of curiosity, inquiry, and a presumption of good faith. But then there was no clarity and more questioning. And then after more data points started to come together, wait a minute, this is just bad. Like the promissory note and other things, like this is an interrelated party transaction. I called them in Enron and I got some flack for that. They're like, oh, are you engagement firm? I'm like, no, this is Enron. And then 4, 5, 6 months later, New York AG said, we're going to go after them. It's fraud, as it was. So that's what it was. It was like kind of pulling that thread, just trying to make sense of it, trying to figure out what the impact is to the price of Bitcoin too, right? Are they going to dump GBTC or not? Those are the cross considerations, trying to make sense of what the hell's happening. But after some time, like, I was like, you know what? This is good, like, volunteer work for the people that were embroiled in those DCG Genesis,
right?
Paying it forward. I had been a victim of these past, like MF Global, I mentioned. I lived through Merrill. I was like, the moment meets the man kind of thing. Like, I'm designed to analyze this. Let me go deep on this.
That's fascinating, man. I'm sure myself and many others that were closely following the bankruptcy are very grateful to you for spending the time and putting your insights out for everyone to see. Funny enough, I don't know if you know this, but we ended up refinancing the large majority of Celsius borrowers out of Celsius bankruptcy. I had a happy ending for them. To your point, I had similar concerns when somebody asked me, how do you feel about Celsius, whether it was in public or in private, because I didn't really want to be perceived as speaking ill of any of my competitors. But it was very frustrating when I had clients at the time withdrawing assets from Ledin. We were paying, I think, 9% on USDC to take it to Celsius because Celsius was paying 12. And I kept telling people, have you asked them where they're getting 12? Because I can show you where my 9 comes from. I turn around, I lend those dollars at 12. That's my spread. I don't see they're lending supposedly at 0. How are they getting 12 at the same risk that we're offering to you? But people didn't see risk then. They just saw yield. For good or bad, people seem to only learn when these shocks hit the market. And I think you're seeing a big renaissance because the level of questions that clients are asking now has been elevated. The type of diligence they're doing has come a long way. Even if you look at some of the newer offerings that are out in the market, they're all fully reserved. Less and less people are doing this race on rates, which eventually leads to rehypothecation and other things. And so
I think it acted as a bit of a reset for the lending industry. It washed away a lot of the bad players, solidified the good ones. And I think we've now been building on a stronger foundation for what's to come.
Crypto's running the lessons of banking and markets history.
100%.
Replication is a lesson as old as time. And now market structure is somewhat better. Still has a lot more to do.
I agree. I saw that you mentioned that you see or expect markets to be materially higher by end of the year. I think the word is significantly or materially, but higher by the end of the year. But that you do expect a lot of chop or volatility along the way because of political reasons and others. But I found interesting that you didn't mention Bitcoin on this most recent newsletter. So I was curious to ask you, could you share a bit of your view in terms of Bitcoin, recent developments in DC, and what you see as driving this idea that markets are going to be going generally higher?
Yeah. So overall, like the number one driver of the S&P is earnings growth. That's number one. And related is also the direction of interest rates. So earnings growth is continuing. Why is it continuing? And why is it going to accelerate? Because you're going to have this animal spirits bump from deregulation and the increased enthusiasm from small business consumers and corporates. By the way, fun fact, I learned yesterday that U.S. military recruitment shot up to a 15-year high in December. All that's because of the Trump election. I remember the day of the election, I had a live space. I said, you're going to see the NFIB Small Business Survey crank higher. And 1 month later, three-year highs. Look at non-farm payrolls that came out in January. Crushed expectations, 200,000 plus jobs. What's happening is animal spirits, which is a term from John Maynard Keynes, right? The idea that people have more confidence in the future and their outlook and their more optimism, and because of that, they want to spend more and make more investment decisions if they're a business owner. And that is creating more economic growth. So earnings growth will be there. On the interest rate front, Bessent said yesterday that Trump wants the long-term rates to go down and Trump isn't pressuring the short-end rate. That's the right idea. It's a pro-growth policy. So that's going to unlock more sources of growth too. So I think it's an up year for the S&P, not as much as it was in the last 2 years, but an up year nonetheless. And however, you know, valuations are in the top decile. So what matters is positioning within the market. Not everything is cheap. You really have to pick your spots at a sector level. And within each sector, you've got to pick within those sectors too. So that's one. On Bitcoin, I shared views in late December. My push to crypto is more like intermediate term. I don't have like a weekly change in view per se. I de-risked a substantial portion of my crypto in mid to late December, actually. And I shared why in one of these December newsletters. What I saw was that Trump election created an extraordinary Trump bump in risk assets, including crypto, and we wanted to ride that higher. But it created a parabola. And so the way I approach digital assets and these high momentum assets is you kind of want to ride them up, but then keep one eye for the exit. And when you see that parabola coming, just rotate and move out. So the expectations around crypto are so high, but the reality, which needs to be delivered, is far below that. You need congressional action. Congress is going to focus on their tax bill down this year, which is going to be hard to do anyway. And the other information I've been hearing from my friends in DC is they're saying, look, Fair Shake PAC was like a morphine drip for these politicians. They don't want to let it go ever. They're hooked on this thing. It's addictive because Fair Shake essentially won every election they competed in, every contest. They need to keep the issues within crypto going. Bizarre. It's really sick, actually. It's frustrating. That's why I just can't stand politicians. They have a motivation not to fix the problem. It's like the farmer lobby from 20 years ago, not crypto. Crypto's one of those powerful lobbies in the United States now. If you fix the problems, then the money goes away. Like they could have gotten a stablecoin bill passed last year. It was bipartisan. They had Democrats like Kristen Gillibrand and Cynthia Lummis, Republican. So that's one. On the other hand, though, Trump family, their wealth is denominated in crypto. They own Bitcoin, they own Ethereum, they own Solana via Trump token. I did participate in the Trump token thing. That was fun. Not enough, though, unfortunately. So overall, I would say this, like, one, we had a parabola. When you have a parabola, it takes 6 months for markets to work that off. That's the observations. So I fade sentiment at extremes. That's one of my approaches. You know, we had a parabola in Ethereum in May. I also sold my Ethereum. I wrote all of these things on Twitter, by the way, every single one. All the three things I told you, I wrote them all on Twitter. And, you know, you want to get in when people are pessimistic again. You want to get in when people are focused on other assets like NVIDIA or something like that. I remember I was home for Thanksgiving and my grandmother on my stepmom's side, she asked me about Bitcoin. I was like, whoa, where'd that come from? She's like in the low 80s. They're exciting from one perspective about adoption, but also top signally, right? That was in November. There clearly was some momentum behind that. But, you know, I started getting these text messages. So my spider sense just goes off. And again, I'm contrarian. So I'm like, well, my orientation was I want to get off the Preble at some point. It was really just timing that was the basic idea. So I think maybe in a few months I will reposition. And I think the question is going to be around this executive order. What happens in this 180 days timeline? A lot of open questions there. The other thing I would say is technically, whales are selling above 100K is something I noticed in December, which is what gave me the conviction to sell, actually, which was, you know, when SEC Chair Gensler announced he's resigning, Bitcoin ramped to 105 and then it sold off. Then they declared his replacement, Paul Atkins, Bitcoin ramped to 105, then it sold off. And then two other things, and it ramped and then it sold off. So I look at that and I say, wait a minute, whales are selling at these levels. So that's kind of my orientation to the asset class right now. But I expect I'd be constructive later in a few months. I do think by year end, though, if you look at the cycle timings, I have mixed feelings about that. Like I spent time with Michael Turpin at Strategy Roundtable. I had him on my podcast as well. And he's like, look, November 2025 is the end of the cycle. It's an interesting data point.
You touched on a few of the questions I had, which was, what do you expect to see out of DC? And we talked about this tax bill. And I also agree with you. I would have expected to see the stablecoin bill way earlier. On this topic of peak sentiment, I've heard you write about this a few times, and this idea of peak sentiment in markets and the fact that when you are at peak sentiment, the market becomes vulnerable to bad news flow or negative headlines, et cetera, and becomes extra vulnerable to these types of changing or contrarian news flow. How can you describe this idea of peak sentiment, and what type of indicators do you look at to get this idea of peak sentiment?
It's a great question. So there's this wonderful quote from Sir John Templeton. He says, bull markets are born on pessimism, they grow on skepticism, they mature on optimism, and they die on euphoria. Such a wonderful quote. And that's what sentiment and really psychology is all about. Markets are all about psychology fundamentally, but the stories and narratives we tell ourselves and each other, including how we assign value, and value is subjective. So the best time to buy crypto was immediately after Genesis failed, after they blocked their accounts. The outlook was bleak. Everyone had panic sold. No one left to sell. That's pessimism. And you can see in the discount to NAV and the ETH and GBTC between 30-50%. You could see it. And that was climbing the wall of worry, which is, well, Elizabeth Warren is coming to the crypto army. It was all priced in. Now we're on the opposite side of that. You have literally MSTRs at a premium to NAV. They went from discounts to premiums. It's not just MSTRs. Many assets are expensive. And that's just the nature of how things work. Remember, in 2022, in that bear market, the only assets that worked were cash and energy stocks. Think about that. Any other asset did not work. There's no way to avoid the pain. You could have bought a house or commercial real estate. You'd have been screwed on that. Equities, you'd be screwed on that. If you bought bonds, you'd be screwed on that too. Think about that. Bonds were 10 years at 1.5%. So all asset classes priced higher at the top of a bubble. We're not there yet. Things are expensive, but we're not there yet. That's the concept around peak sentiment. So there are these moments of mini euphorias that happen. Remember when Trump spoke at the UN, which is hilarious, by the guy is on a Zoom call and he's the topic of conversation. And he's like, I'm going to give all of you guys tariffs here. Tariff you, you, and you. It's like Oprah, except instead of cars or tariffs. That wasn't really his message, by the way. It was a subtext, but he said, look, I want everyone to lower interest rates around the world, number one. And then that same day, a Project Stargate come out, where you had four people, including Trump, Sam Altman, and others were there saying, we're going to spend $500 billion to build AGI. That's a peak sentiment. Everyone's like, yeah, let's go do this. And you can measure it. I took a screenshot of that day. Every index was up. Credit spreads tightened, international tightened, US sectors were up, cyclicals were up, and defensives, and rate sensitive, anything was up. That's one of the markers of a peak sentiment event. Essentially, it's a decline in risk aversion. If you want to put it in an economist's perspective, it's a decline in risk aversion, or a bump in what we call animal spirits. People get excited. It's a real phenomenon. A trader that makes a bunch of money in a day, everyone's been there at some point. That is what animal spirits feels like.
It's actually so funny when you hit the exact same question that I had for you, which is, as someone who's very active in public markets, you follow valuations. I've been really dying to speak to someone like you here. What's your take on strategy now, formerly known as MicroStrategy, and other companies replicating that model? Like, how do you think this movie plays out?
I mean, first of all, Michael Saylor, what he's done is brilliant. I've had the chance to meet him few times. He's a wonderful storyteller and communicator. And Bitcoin needed that leadership. There was no Satoshi. You need a voice people can point to. And he played a very important role for Bitcoin, not to mention the flows and financing the purchase of Bitcoin. It's real. Everyone should send Michael Saylor like 0.1 Bitcoin. I don't like the change to strategy. Here's why. Markets are all about psychology. That's my principle number one. So you don't want people looking to the left or to the right when you're going up a bubble. You want them looking straight into Valhalla, which is the promised land. You want them looking straight and not thinking. You want them to be on the bus cheerleading, rah, rah, rah. That's what you want. So when you do something like, hey, we're going to change the name to strategy, it caused people to stop, reflect, and think, well, why are we doing that? He actually had an incredible streak on CNBC. I listened to what he said. I was like, wow. His message is like right on target. He was just bouncing, you know, return. He's like a tennis metaphor. And then CNBC asked him this one question, like, and he said, well, it's better than commercial real estate because of this and that and the other thing. I was like, man, he should not have answered that way because it caused people to think critically. Bubbles are about just being a part of that. We're staying long. We're going to Valhalla. Let's do this thing. Let's go, go, go. Hodl, 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 hold, hold, hold. I don't like that name change. I don't think it helps.
Well, my other question for you on this topic is, I've had a few interesting discussions. I had Raoul Powell on the show a few weeks back, and we got talking about potential pockets of risk in the market around MicroStrategy. So this is coming up more and more as I talk to people in the space, particularly people that manage size or are involved, and they have such a large portfolio that they have to have spot and equities and all this stuff. There seems to be this theme coming up that this whole MicroStrategy looks too good to be true. How long can this continue? And people are starting to try to find if there are any pockets of risk that the market is unaware of. Do you have any of those concerns, or do you see that there could be any pockets?
No risks out there, certainly. There are two bubbles that are in place right now. And bubbles aren't necessarily bad. You want to be in the bubble and ride it up. I am participating in the data center bubble. It's a great bubble. You guys should get out and join the fun. It's a great way. I got NVIDIA, Celestica, Flex, some semiconductors, Meta, Google. It's a wonderful bubble. There are two bubbles. One is the bubble on animal spirits, and the bubble in quality stocks, which is really funny because these are like antithesis of each other. So the bubble in quality stocks, like look at Costco. Costco has a forward PE ratio of 50 times. It's much more expensive than NVIDIA. Walmart, pricier than NVIDIA. FICO, pricier than NVIDIA. So quality stocks are what Berkshire Hathaway would technically call a quality business. These are businesses that are indestructible. They're AI proof. They've got a dominant competitive advantage. They've got a deep moat, recurring cash flows, pristine balance sheets, and they lead their market. They just grow, grow, grow. They're wonderful businesses, but they're no longer at a fair price. So there's a bubble in quality, not all quality stocks, but those names and others too. So then you've got a bubble at animal spirits like Tesla, which is like a PE ratio of who knows what. It's essentially a meme stock now. And the reason I mention that is because both Tesla and MicroStrategy are technically deteriorating right now. So animal spirits, parts of that bubble are leaking now. So, you know, uranium had a nice rally, and these are all correlated. People that own Bitcoin, and if they also own equities, I tend to own Tesla, MicroStrategy, and funny enough, like uranium. I see my own clientele, we're wealth management business. I talk to my clients, and there's an unusual correlation with uranium. Well, why? It's a material, it's scarce, and it's linked to energy, literally, right? I mean, what's Bitcoin? Trapped energy, what's uranium? It's energy, right? So I said on that Bips and Bits podcast in December, MicroStrategy may have hit its local top as well. After we saw that right shoulder break. That's the key with bubbles. It's best to just wait for the right shoulder. Don't try to get ahead of it. Enjoy the ride. Pay your dues on the back end. When you got that one big red candle, you're going to be down 10%. Who cares? You were up 10% the week before. It doesn't matter. So I think overall, animal spirits and quality bubble are probably going to be leaking the next couple of months. And you're going to have more rotation to value. You know, if you look at like growth stocks versus value stocks, growth stocks are like two standard deviations of the norm right now. But meanwhile, if you compare like Meta, NVIDIA, and Google, they're cheaper than these other stocks out there, like MongoDB or Team or Snowflake, these software stocks. They're far more expensive, and they don't have the same dominant competitive advantages as these hyperscalers, which are monopolies and can influence government and hang out with Trump at Mar-a-Lago whenever they want, right? So meaning it's not like a single pocket. There's a similar buyer base behind all these things, similar driving all of that up. So the question is, when that group isn't seeing P&L gains, or worse, are seeing P&L declines, they're going to pull back on their other assets too, because some of them are margin and levered long. That's what caused these markets to correlate too, because when they get hit on one asset, their risk aversion won't go up. If they're getting hit on MicroStrategy is down 30%, they're more sensitive to losses than other assets that are correlated and similar, uranium or Tesla. They pull back there. And then that has another effect onto the initial asset and so forth and so forth. So you need new inflows from like sovereign wealth funds, which may well happen. I think Dubai, I think maybe Saudi Arabia, I think UAE, I think there are sovereigns looking at Bitcoin value, which is all good news. It's a question of timing. Can they show up fast enough, right?
And they're not typically FOMO chasers, these wealth funds. Well, I guess it depends, really, because they're all human.
Yeah, it takes time to get these agreements in place and the purchase orders in place and figure it out and all that. I hope that in the next couple of months, we'll have some favorable entry opportunities. I might be wrong. That's fine. We got in Q1 of 23, had a nice run. It's about discipline, right?
100%. You explained your strategy so well. It makes a lot of sense and it's been working. So stick to the discipline that's brought you to where you are. You spoke about the clients you work with, and I do have a question around what is the typical client that Lumida works with and what type of work do you do with your clients?
Many of them are exited founders and 2/3 of them are crypto natives that created material wealth and digital assets. So my first client made $1 billion in digital currency. It's wild. This guy is kind of incredible. Lives in Puerto Rico, very humble guy, married with kid and just a wonderful, wonderful human being. Another client who is mid-40s, multi-generational lumber family with significant wealth. And we actually don't even invest in crypto. We're doing public equities and other things and deals like CoreWeave with him. One day I was like, how did you find out about us? He said, oh, you were talking about Solana one day and I own some Solana. We're like, oh, wow, that's cool. So it's a forward-thinking crowd. It's a non-consensus crowd, an original-thinking crowd. You know, you attract what you put out in the world. They're fascinating people. We learn from them, too. We learn from our clients all the time because they have areas of expertise. You know, they created wealth somehow. It's always like they're operators, they're doers, they're builders. They created wealth, and they believe the world is changing, and they want to be part of what are the major trends.
That's fascinating. And obviously, you cover a breadth of investment opportunities ranging from equities. One of the things I really like is to have a view on any one sector, you kind of have to have the whole picture.
Exactly right. I mean, isn't that obvious? Like you just said it. That's exactly right. How can you not, if you're being a fiduciary, like we talked about the linkage between Bitcoin, Tesla, and uranium. And if you look at a chart, you'll see relationships. But imagine if you were not looking at that information and you're only looking at Bitcoin, then what?
Sometimes I find that I show the overlapping global liquidity chart with Bitcoin and people are like, oh my God, they're watching this chart for the first time. And it feels to me like you have been driving without the lights on for that long.
Yeah, all markets are related to one another. So it's very important to understand the ebbs and the flows. And trends take years to play out. The master of this is Stanley Druckenmiller, of course.
He's a genius.
I would say that's who I'm trying to emulate as best as I possibly can. But I think he has the right idea. You got to look across asset classes. Sometimes equities are the move, sometimes crypto, sometimes bills, sometimes bonds. You have to look at the broader picture.
100%. I used to think bonds were the most boring thing on the planet. Now I actually think they are the easiest things to understand and follow because the government, they are the only one where the main issuer has openly stated policy goals that they can't go against. And it's almost like you're playing against a deck of cards that's laid versus you're playing against someone that's holding the cards here. It's not perfect, but it makes your life much easier as an investor because you know their constraints, you know what they've promised, and you look at the same data. So it's super interesting for me to watch bonds now. I find them very interesting, which makes me sound probably like a finance nerd, but it's fascinating. I think as an investor, you have to understand these interplays. And many times that's why people that are so busy in their business and have a portfolio to manage look into people like yourselves, because that's your full-time job is to really gauge where this is at.
If you want to excel, it takes dedication and focus. Equities and crypto are about psychology and stories, and bonds are about cash flows, credit, underwriting, timing. So it is a different kind of analytical skill, but it's the foundation of other markets. You need a well-functioning bond market.
The risk-free rate, right, that we all go by. Ram, where can our listeners learn more about you and Lumida?
We have a newsletter, which you referenced, called Lumida Ledger. Lumida spelled L-U-M-I-D-A. Our website's lumidawealth.com. I'm also on Twitter at Ram Ahluwalia, R-A-M. Ahluwalia. I'm on LinkedIn as well. Lumida is a company I founded, and we're a cross-asset class investor focused on exited founders, crypto natives, builders, really. Yeah, we're creating content and doing more curations and really building a community. We've got a public Telegram. We've got a great vibe in there. I love the vibe in there. We talk about markets and Asian longevity. It's fun.
I'll have to join the Telegram group. I follow you on Twitter. I just subscribed last night. By the way, for anyone listening, it's free alpha. Like, go follow Ram. Go sign up to the newsletter. It's epic. And man, I hope we could do this again in a little bit and see how your views play out and how the parabolas that we're in play out and the administration changes. We won't have a shortage of things to talk about, I think, for the next little while. So
overall, look, I'm optimistic about the future. We're gonna get real innovation, real growth. Never been better to be a human being. And it's an exciting, wonderful time.
Thank you so much for stopping by and making the time to join us. I look forward to our next chat.
Always a pleasure, Mauricio. Thank you.
As Ram very eloquently described, all financial markets are interconnected. As a professional investor, it's very important to understand these interdependent dynamics. Doing so can help you assess where in the market cycle we are and what could be up next. One of my favorite points he made was this idea of peak sentiment in the markets and why he takes a defensive approach when markets are euphoric. We all like to think of markets as these rational organisms that perfectly price in all known information. But the reality is that markets are made up of humans, and the way we make decisions varies greatly as our circumstances change. This is why you may have seen people overspend when they get into some new money, or tighten their belts when they experience a loss. The same happens at a macro level. I really encourage all of you to check out Ram's content on X and to subscribe to his free newsletter. It's a great source of market insights and always a good checkpoint to see where your views on the market are compared to those of a professional. Thanks again, and we'll be back soon with another great guest. If you enjoyed this Because of Bitcoin episode, I would be very grateful for the 5 seconds it would take you to drop us a review and give us a rating on your favorite podcasting platform. This will really help us reach even more listeners. And if you'd like to learn more about Bitcoin, be sure to check out our newsletter by subscribing at ledn.io. That's ledn.io. Again, this was Mauricio Di Bartolomeo. Stay tuned for our next episode. And until then, muchas gracias y los quiero mucho. Ciao, ciao.